This is a Suno India production and you're listening to the Suno India Show.
Maitri Mishra is the project head of Deathworthy, a report about the impact of the death sentence on the mental health of people receiving it. Her team spoke to 88 prisoners on death row across 5 states and their families as well. The findings are stark.
Academically speaking, the findings were, they were genuinely a massive surprise for me. I did not expect, we knew that there is a mental health crisis, but the extent of the crisis was absolutely something that took me by surprise, that there are more than 30% of the prisoners living with depression, 34 contemplating suicide, and nobody really knows about this. That there are 9 people, or close to 11% of the prisoners, had intellectual disability. I was not expecting to find such stark data.
Maitri is a founding member of Project 39A at the National Law University, Delhi. She heads mental health and criminal justice and also death penalty mitigation. Her team made a short animation clip to present this report. It tells the story of Dharmaketu, a man on death row. This is a story of not just how people's mental health deteriorates on death row, but also how usually many death row convicts have a fragile mental state to begin with.
These voices aren't real, but for Dharmaketu, they are. He's a prisoner sentenced to death in one of India's prisons. These voices get so disturbing that Dharmaketu has attempted to die by suicide in prison. When he was 12, his parents took him to a traditional healer because they felt there was something wrong with his brain. It did not help. Dharmaketu dropped out of school and was violated physically and sexually as an adolescent. He was sexually abused multiple times by people in his neighborhood and in his workplace. People he trusted. He did not receive any formal treatment until he was incarcerated. Dharmaketu spent close to 15 years in prison, including over 6 years on death row, an experience that has caused him psychological distress, uncertainty about life and death. It was in prison that he was first properly treated for the voices. Dharmaketu was diagnosed with psychosis NOS, major depressive disorder, and intellectual disability. Dharmaketu isn't alone. 62.2% death row prisoners are diagnosed with at least one mental illness. 46 out of the 88 prisoners interviewed had been abused as children, 64 neglected, 46 had to drop out of school early, and 73 prisoners grew up in a disturbed family environment. And the mental agony of being on death row pushes them further.
When we hear about someone getting the death penalty on the news, the story starts from the crime. But this study argues that the story of even our most condemned criminals is much more than that. Hi, I am Suryatapa Mukherjee reporting on this episode of the Suno India Show. Today we are looking at the impact of the death row on prisoners' mental health and if people with mental health struggles are more likely to end up on the death row to begin with. Maitri and her team looked into adverse childhood experiences of those on death row. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACE, are certain traumatic events or situations that a person has grown up with. These can have a tremendous impact on future violence in their life, with them being re-victimized or perpetrating violence against others. These can also predict lifelong health and access to opportunities. Out of 10, most death row inmates had a score of 3 or more such adverse childhood experiences.
We particularly looked at adverse childhood experiences. These adverse childhood experiences have in literature, in psychiatric mental health literature, been found to have links with both mental illness later in life, as well as violence and aggression later in life. In other words, also criminal behavior. We found that 73 prisoners were exposed to 3 or more adverse childhood experiences. These experiences also do not stay in silos. They interact with each other. And we found that prisoners who had been abused as children also had to take on responsibilities of an adult during their childhood. And also many of them ran away from home during childhood. We also found that of the 63 prisoners who were neglected as children, many reported associating with deviant peers, and quite a few of them did not have education up till even class 10. Of the large number of prisoners, the very large number of prisoners that grew up in a disturbed family environment, a majority of them had to assume adult roles. They also associated with deviant peers, and they started using substances before they turned 18. In addition to these vulnerabilities, we also looked at events that in literature are known as traumatic life events. We looked at 17 traumatic life events, and these life events become important because research has shown to have for them to have a link with mental illness later in life. Some of the traumatic life events that we looked at were physical assault, sudden and unexpected death of a close one, transportation accident, severe human suffering, and experiencing a life-threatening illness or injury. 56 death row prisoners were exposed to 3 or more traumatic events.
For an example, here's the story of Mahadev, one of those included in the study.
Mahadev grew up in a conflict-ridden household with an alcoholic father who would often abuse him and his mother verbally and physically. The abuse was so bad at times that his mother had to be admitted to the hospital for treatment. When he was 9 months old, his father, in a fit of rage, threw a water drum at him because he wouldn't stop crying. His mother was the one who paid for Mahadev and his sister's education. He blames his father's drinking problem for the chaotic environment in his home throughout his childhood. He felt cheated when his uncle, on the promise of admitting him into a school, took him away from his house and made him work at the shop the entire day. He abused him with a hot ladle, the marks of which are still present on Mahadev's body. Whenever he watches family drama movies in prison, he cries bitterly as he misses his grandparents a lot. They are unable to travel the long distance due to old age. He is heartbroken as his family has burnt all his photographs out of fear and humiliation after they saw how the media covered the crime.
Dr. Pratima Murthy, the director of NIMHANS Bangalore, further expanded on how early childhood experiences can shape a criminal future if there is no help or intervention. She was speaking at the report's release event.
But what stands out in these stories is this socioeconomic adversity, low educational attainment, early adultification, children going to work at the age of 9 and 10, and a host of other disadvantages. So multiple and long-term exposure to stressful events can have serious health consequences for any of us, including bringing about a change in the brain itself. And repeated exposure to negative events can particularly increase the risk to disorders like depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress disorders. And negative experiences also change the behavioral and the cognitive responses to subsequent stressful events and increase an individual's reactivity to these events and experiences. So there is persistent and often an intergenerational social and structural exclusion, deprivation, and violence in a majority of the persons who were interviewed. Enough and more research indicates that the experiences presented in the various chapters, including the neglect during childhood, the disturbed family environment, poverty and deprivation, are underlying determinants of violence in later life. And of course, the important thing is that in the absence of support, the effects of these are amplified further. Such hostile environments, particularly in the formative years of a person, act as risk factors leaving the person vulnerable to the risk of poor social outcomes, including violent behavior, suicidal attempts, as well as poor physical and mental health in later life.
Before we can really talk about the mental health of people after they are on death row, it is necessary to look at their mental health before they end up there. So does our justice system look at it, and how closely? Section 84 of the Indian Penal Code 1860 says nothing is an offence which is done by a person who at the time of doing it, by reason of unsoundness of mind, is incapable of knowing the nature of the act, or that he is doing what is either wrong or contrary to the law. Section 30 in the Prisoners Act 1900 says that if a person is later found to be of unsound mind by the government, they would be moved to a lunatic asylum for treatment for the remainder of their sentence. They can be detained in asylum for longer if they need further treatment, or released earlier if they become of sound mind. Sections 328, 329 and 330 of Code of Criminal Procedure 1973 lay down the procedure for cases where during the trial an accused is suspected to be of unsound mind. The magistrate can have the accused assessed, and if proven so, depending on the case, they can be released or moved to a psychiatric facility for treatment.
Even within the death penalty jurisprudence, you have law to say that persons with mental illness should not be executed. Okay? The question is, and the problem is, what are the mental illnesses that will qualify for this exemption? And that is not clear. And there is no good reason for why that should not be clear, but it's not.
It is not true, of course, that anyone with any sort of mental illness or condition is incapable of committing crimes. So how does our law deal with such nuances? According to our law, legal insanity is different from medical insanity. It does not excuse all kinds of mental illnesses. It only sees if the person understood what they were doing when they committed the crime. For example, take the case of S.K. Nair versus State of Punjab, 1996. Nair worked in the Air Force and attacked others living in his barrack, killing one. Nair was receiving treatment for paranoia, and his doctor had in fact said he should be discharged from the Air Force. However, the court held that Nair was not in a state of paranoia when he was committing the crimes. He was aware of what he was doing, so he was sentenced to life imprisonment. In State of Orissa versus Kalia alias Debabroto Maharana 2008, the accused was sentenced to death for murdering three people by a Sessions court. The accused was receiving treatment for paranoid schizophrenia, but the court held that he was not legally insane. On appeal, the High Court decided that he was legally insane, and he was sent for examination to see if he could be freed immediately or if he should be sent to a psychiatric facility. So although the law has exemptions in place for mental illness, the law is only concerned with the moment of the crime. It does not take the accused's life history into account or the nuances of how their history may have impacted their present. In many cases, the accused does not have the resources to even find out that they have a mental illness in the first place. And if the lawyer does not know, it does not come up in court.
A lot of these mental health issues, right? How will the accused even know? They are coming largely from poorer backgrounds. The legal system relies only on lawyers as the defense. And lawyers don't have the skills to collect the information that we have collected. We did this interviews along with psychologists and other social workers, mental health professionals. So lawyers don't have that skill to collect this kind of information. So we need to really think about changing perhaps our legal aid system. Perhaps we need to include social workers as part of a defense team. If we are a system that is going to condemn somebody to death, the least it can do is to ensure that it is absolutely sure that this person deserves the death penalty. And for that, structural changes in the legal system are required. Another of the findings of the report, 9 prisoners out of 83 prisoners had intellectual disability, and it was never brought to the attention of the courts. And under international human rights law, persons with intellectual disability are exempt from the death penalty itself because of the nature of the disability.
This is how people with mental illnesses and disabilities can end up not only in prison, but on death row. And their already fragile state of mind crumbles. Dr. Sanjeev Jain, professor of psychiatry from NIMHANS, draws out how this happens.
Modern law specifically tries to explicitly state that we are not in the space of retribution or revenge, but are driven by reason and concern, and where possible, a promise of reform. A lifetime on death row of ambiguity, of hanging in literally a no man's land, of not knowing, as was pointed out, sometimes the individual sees the preparations for the death row in progress. Mercy petitions are held pending for months and years, and the person is absolutely unaware whether he'll be alive the next day. In addition to that, all the administrative rules that have been alluded to, living a life of isolation, being looked at very differently, not allowed to work, not allowed to meet people. Now, this kind of social isolation, not the social isolation that COVID has induced, but the very real physical isolation that these people endure, produces long-term damage to the brain. Perhaps the most driving motivation in almost all primates, and humans are primates, is the need for human contact. And you know, we've known for years that people will do anything to have a hug, to have a pleasant conversation, to actually feel wanted by another person at any level. So the lack of that kind of environment produces this high rates of depression, the high rate of anxiety, the high rates of mental distress that we see affect almost 3/4 of the people on death row. So this kind of unnecessary, in a sense, medical cruelty in which we are fomenting a chronic mental trauma, fomenting a state of depression, is simply not appropriate for a modern society.
Maitreyi says that most death row inmates in the study found out that they have a mental illness or disability after they were in prison. So what are the resources and facilities available to such prisoners?
The Mental Health Care Act mandates that the state establish at least one mental health establishment in one prison within its territory. Right? So one mental health establishment, which is the mental health ward, that the act requires the state to put in. But the problem is, you have to understand, this is all mental health in general, right, is in the context of poor resources, poor mental health resources in the country, including the lack of sufficient number of psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health professionals. So prisons become even less of a priority, even though our national mental health policy recognizes people in detention, such as prisons, as being more vulnerable. It's a recognized vulnerable category. But you have less resources within, which are allocated within prison for mental health services. So the quality is actually quite bad. We found that not a lot of the people who we found had depression or anxiety were not being treated for it. And when I say treatment, I mean both medicine and also talking therapy. Because you just don't have that many resources. You also don't have, your prisons are also overcrowded. And ultimately, these are people who are on death row, right? So whether you're going to accord legitimacy to their experience and to their illness, and illnesses, particularly illnesses such as depression, is an entirely different question. So the services are very bad, even though particularly for death row prisoners, the Supreme Court has said that there has to be regular mental health evaluations. Because the court has recognized in multiple judgments that being on death row is a troubling experience. It's recognized that many people break down, It's recognized in its own way. It's recognized what it calls nervous breakdowns while living on death row. So there is a recognition that death row can lead to mental health concerns, and the court has tried to rectify that by saying there should be regular mental health evaluations. But let's remember that mental health evaluations, mental health treatment are curative. They are not preventative. So we very well might be pushing them into a mental illness and then saying, we'll now treat you for it. So it's a bit of a warped logic, in my opinion.
In a 2019 case, a convict who had been on death row for 17 years for the rape and murder of two minors appealed for his sentence to be commuted on the basis of developing mental illness after being on death row. In a landmark judgment, the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. The three-judge bench held that the punishment is a message to the convict about the consequence of their action. If due to post-conviction mental illness, the convict is unable to understand that message, then the sentencing loses its purpose. The top court acknowledged that prisoners tend to have, quote, increased affinity to mental illness. It also spoke of realities within the prison walls which can compound and complicate such problems. The death row, however, does not only affect the mental health of the prisoner in question, but their family as well. Maitreyi explains.
The criminal justice system has no place, has made no space for families. So the families don't have a voice within the system, families of death row prisoners. Outside of the system, society has held them guilty by association. Their houses are razed, they have to leave their house, where they may have been staying for generations. So they have to rebuild a new life. Not only are they materially on a back foot, there is a person who they love, who is part of their family, who has been sentenced to death. So there's that psychological trauma. The problem is that this kind of trauma, that how one way of dealing with trauma is to be able to talk about it, to be able to live through it more meaningfully by talking to it through support structures. They don't have any support. So they are completely stripped of financial, material, emotional support that they derived earlier from their community, because now they are they have to leave that community. And I don't think our society allows families to grieve for their loved one because they are on death row. Right, you're already what in literature is called disenfranchised grief. You're not allowed to express it, and a lot of the narratives were like that. This woman, her daughter told us that she doesn't tell people that her mother was on death row because you're going to not be able to express it in a way which helps you deal with it. It's going to be laughed at, or worse, you're going to be punished for the fact that a parent is on death row. It creates that kind of an alternate reality, right? Particularly for children, because many children, for instance, they were told that their parent was working in a factory, was away and working in a factory, not even told that they are in prison. Forget death row. They're going to come to know eventually. Some families, for instance, hide the identity, hide the fact that they have a loved one on death row, and they continue living their life. So they are living in two different realities, one reality for the outside world and one reality, a very different reality for themselves. And then they have to live through all of this absolutely alone, because as society, as a legal system, we don't have a response to that. We've never paid attention to this population who is going through a trauma of a very, very different kind.
What does all of this mean? The report itself acknowledges that when talking about the mental health of death row inmates, people who have committed severe crimes, many may ask, so what? Why should we care?
if I told you that this child is being abused, you would get angry. You would feel bad for that child, and you would feel anger towards the person who's abusing the child. But when it comes to a prisoner who's sentenced to death, and I told you that they were abused as children, we suddenly don't care. How do we start squaring our responsibility towards prisoners when they were children and being neglected, abused, lived through severe poverty, with the fact that the death sentence is also given in our name? But we were the ones who neglected in the first place. So how do we square this? And I think the report tries to get us to confront ourselves with that question.
What this report reveals is that caring about death row prisoners really means taking care of our children. It means looking at all the ways in which we as a society fail our children who come from impoverished backgrounds, are abused or neglected by the adults around them, and have mental health issues. Dr. Sanjeev explains.
There was an individual who's expelled from school, who has recurrent violence, is sent to a village home, village environment to learn discipline and perhaps distract him from all this, enters into a fight, bites off his classmate's ears, again sent back to the village. A classical presentation of what we would call attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, unsocialized conduct disorder, if a psychiatrist and if mental health services had been available to this young child at 10, would the outcome on the death row been different? So even the awareness of this kinds of violence, or a forerunner of the events that do happen, do need to be understood. Medical science, including psychiatry, has made significant progress over the last few, at least a century or half a century. Instead of a blanket term of insanity, which is what was in use in the early part of the 20th century, we now have specific disease syndromes. And these are now increasingly understood as, to a large extent, brain disorders. So head injuries, as we saw in a couple of individuals, chronic infections, somebody had a chronic ear infection and probable abscess of the brain in the temporal part of the brain, which predisposes to violence. We had several people with epilepsy, schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, psychosis, and of course, addiction, and during intoxication, they can be very, very abnormal behavior. So the consequence of this behavior, that is the terms of punishment, therefore need to keep in mind the very real impairment of logic, affect, social understanding, and even intelligence that all these individuals may manifest as a consequence of diseases.
This doesn't mean that everybody with mental health struggles commits crimes. Dr. Pratima invites us to take a closer look at why. What separates a child who experiences trauma and suffers from mental disabilities, who grows up to land on the death row, from one who doesn't?
Take the case of Amar Manohar, who had every possible adverse childhood experience, including abuse, absence of parents, lack of caregiver support, no support for early learning, early adultification, early onset of substance use and behavioral problems, association with deviant peers, parental substance use and hostility, multiple social adversities, all before the age of 18 years, including exposure to accident and writing. I mean, what can you expect? And of course, I'm sure the question that pops up in everybody's head is that every Amar does not land up on death row. That is a question we must seek to answer. What are the factors that can prevent people like this from becoming, landing up in situations like they are presently? Can we prevent deviant children from becoming deviant adults through an appropriate environment and through fostering proper community support? How do we develop resilience to adapt themselves to adverse situations while managing their mental well-being in an effective manner? Like vulnerabilities, resilience also depends on individuals as well as social factors. Individuals who have been exposed to a nurturing and supportive family environment are more resilient in stressful situations. Our obligation to do this in society is also important because it will reduce victimhood in society at a later date. Another important group inherent in this whole issue are the unwitting victims of collateral damage, the families. Families become condemned as guilty by association, and the collateral damage that is caused to families because of stigma, loss, ostracization, and grief that they suffered is unimaginable. And that's what we actually witnessed when we spoke to the more than 100 families.
The solution may be to strengthen our social structures and support systems to intervene in the lives of these children to help them before it's too late. As Pratima says, this would not only help the child in question but also save their future victims from being victimized. Currently, the death row adds to the list of traumatic experiences in this person's life, and it creates fresh trauma for their families and children, carrying it into the next generation. Such convicts are dehumanized by us, our society, our media, so much so that when I asked Maitreyi what surprised her during the study, she said it was their humanity. It was the fact that she could relate to them.
I think it was surprising how easily you actually can identify with a person who everyone else is saying deserves to die when you start talking to them. That they have life stories, that they are loved by someone, that they are worrying about children, that they are worrying about their children's education, that they are very much capable of the same emotions as us on the outside, right? Because the narrative is so much hate and so much othering that it is surprising that you and them might be laughing on the same thing. But I think what was also heart-wrenching and sort of uncomfortable was talking to the families, talking to the prisoners about the kind of violence they've had during their childhood, the families admitting many times to the violence that they inflicted on the child. So yeah, so that was sort of gut-wrenching in a way. And I think as a person who's gone through depression myself, some of my sort of memories are of being confronted with a person who has depression, which has not been identified in prison, and going, I know what this person must be feeling. I know the darkness where they are right now. And I think that was surprising.
Please rate our podcast and leave a comment if you like it. Underreported and underrepresented stories can become mainstream only if it reaches more people. So please support us by visiting our contributing page on our website sunoindia.in or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.